draws cosmic energy as well as light from the astral brain and pumps it into the astral nerves and body cells, or lifetrons. Astral beings are able to effect changes in their form by lifetronic force and by holy mantric vibrations. In most cases, the astral body is an exact counterpart of the last physical form. The face and figure of an astral person resembles those of his youth in his previous earthly sojourn. Occasionally, someone, like myself, chooses to retain his old-age appearance. Master, emanating the very essence of youth, chuckled merrily. Unlike the spatial, three-dimensional physical world, cognized only by the five senses, the astral spheres are visible to the all-inclusive sixth sense, intuition. Sri Yukteswar went on, "By sheer intuitional feeling, all astral beings see, hear, smell, taste, and touch. They possess three eyes, two of which are partly closed. The third and chief astral eye, vertically placed on the forehead, is open. Astral beings have all the outer sensory organs, ears, eyes, nose, tongue, and skin, but they employ the intuitional sense to experience sensations through any part of the body. They can see through the ear or nose or skin. They are able to hear through the eyes or tongue, and can taste through the ears or skin, and so forth. Man's physical body is exposed to countless dangers, and is easily hurt or maimed. The ethereal astral body may occasionally be cut or bruised, but is healed at once by mere willing. Gurudeva, are all astral persons beautiful? Beauty in the astral world is known to be a spiritual quality and not an outward conformation, Sri Yukteswar replied. Astral beings therefore attach little importance to facial features. They have the privilege, however, of costuming themselves at will with new, colourful, astrally materialized bodies. Just as worldly men don new array for gala events, so astral beings find occasions to bedeck themselves in specially designed forms. Joyous astral festivities on the higher astral planets like Hiranyaloka take place when a being is liberated from the astral world through spiritual advancement and is therefore ready to enter the heaven of the causal world. On such occasions, the invisible Heavenly Father and the saints who are merged in him materialize themselves into bodies of their own choice and join the astral celebration. In order to please his beloved devotee, the Lord takes any desired form. If the devotee worshipped through devotion, he sees God as the Divine Mother. To Jesus, the Father aspect of the Infinite One was appealing beyond other conceptions. The individuality with which the Creator has endowed each of his creatures makes every conceivable and inconceivable demand on the Lord's versatility. My Guru and I laughed happily together. Friends of other lives easily recognize one another in the astral world, Sri Yukteswar went on in his beautiful flute-like voice. Rejoicing at the immortality of friendship, they realize the indestructibility of love, often doubted at the time of the sad, delusive partings of earthly life. The intuition of astral beings pierces through the veil and observes human activity on earth, but man cannot view the astral world unless his sixth sense is somewhat developed. Thousands of earth dwellers have momentarily glimpsed an astral being or an astral world. The advanced beings on Hiranyaloka remain mostly awake in ecstasy during the long astral day and night, helping to work out intricate problems of cosmic government and the redemption of prodigal sons, earthbound souls. When the Hiranyaloka beings sleep, they have occasional dreamlike astral visions. Their minds are usually engrossed in the conscious state of highest nirvikalpa bliss. Inhabitants in all parts of the astral worlds are still subject to mental agonies. The sensitive minds of the higher beings on planets like Hiranyaloka feel keen pain if any mistake is made in conduct or perception of truth. These advanced beings endeavor to attune their every act and thought with the perfection of spiritual law. Communication among the astral inhabitants is held entirely by astral telepathy and television. There is none of the confusion and misunderstanding of the written and spoken word which earth dwellers must endure. Just as persons on the cinema screen appear to move and act through a series of light pictures and do not actually breathe, so the astral beings walk and work as intelligently guided and coordinated images of light, without the necessity of drawing power from oxygen. Man depends on solids, liquids, gases, and energy for sustenance. Astral beings sustain themselves principally by cosmic light. Master mine, do astral beings eat anything? I was drinking in his marvelous elucidations with the receptivity of all my faculties, mind, heart, soul. Superconscious perceptions of truth are permanently real and changeless, while fleeting sense experiences and impressions are never more than temporarily or relatively true, and soon lose in memory all their vividness. My guru's words were so penetratingly imprinted on the parchment of my being that at any time, by transferring my mind to the superconscious state, I can clearly relive the divine experience. Luminous, ray-like vegetables abound in the astral soils, he answered. The astral beings consume vegetables and drink a nectar flowing from glorious fountains of light and from astral brooks and rivers. Just as invisible images of persons on earth can be dug out of the ether and made visible by a television apparatus, later being dismissed again into space, so the God-created, unseen astral blueprints of vegetables and plants floating in the ether are precipitated on an astral planet by the will of its inhabitants. In the same way, from the wildest fancy of these beings, whole gardens of fragrant flowers are materialized, returning later to the etheric invisibility. Although dwellers on the heavenly planets like Hiranyaloka are almost freed from any necessity of eating, still higher is the unconditioned existence of almost completely liberated souls in the causal world who eat nothing save the manna of bliss. The earth-liberated astral being meets a multitude of relatives, fathers, mothers, wives, husbands, and friends acquired during different incarnations on earth, as they appear from time to time in various parts of the astral realms. He is therefore at a loss to understand whom to love especially. He learns in this way to give a divine and equal love to all, as children and individualized expressions of God. Though the outward appearance of loved ones may have changed, more or less according to the development of new qualities in the latest life of any particular soul, the astral being employs his unerring intuition to recognize all those once dear to him in other planes of existence, and to welcome them to their new astral home. Because every atom in creation is inextinguishably dowered with individuality, an astral friend will be recognized no matter what costume he may don. Even as on earth, an actor's identity is discoverable by close observation, despite any disguise. The span of life on the astral world is much longer than on earth. A normal advanced astral being's average life period is from 500 to 1,000 years, measured in accordance with earthly standards of time. As certain redwood trees outlive most trees by millenniums, or as some yogis live several hundred years, though most men die before the age of 60, so some astral beings live much longer than the usual span of astral existence. Visitors to the astral world dwell there for a longer or shorter period in accordance with the weight of their physical karma, which draws them back to earth within a specified time. The astral being does not have to contend painfully with death at the time of shedding his luminous body. Many of these beings nevertheless feel slightly nervous at the thought of dropping their astral form for the subtler causal one. The astral world is free from unwilling death, disease, and old age. These three dreads are the curse of earth, where man has allowed his consciousness to identify itself almost wholly with a frail physical body requiring constant aid from air, food, and sleep in order to exist at all. Physical death is attended by the disappearance of breath and the disintegration of fleshly cells. Astral death consists of the disbursement of lifetrons, those manifest units of energy which constitute the life of astral beings. At physical death, a being loses his consciousness of flesh and becomes aware of his subtle body in the astral world. Experiencing astral death in due time, a being thus passes from the consciousness of astral birth and death to that of physical birth and death. These recurrent cycles of astral and physical encasement are the ineluctable destiny of all unenlightened beings. Scriptural definitions of heaven and hell sometimes stir man's deeper than subconscious memories of his long series of experiences in the blithesome astral and disappointing terrestrial worlds. Beloved Master, I asked, will you please describe more in detail the difference between rebirth on the earth and in the astral and causal spheres? Man, as an individualized soul, is essentially causal-bodied, my guru explained. That body is a matrix of the 35 ideas required by God as the basic or causal thought forces from which he later formed the subtle astral body of 19 elements and the gross physical body of 16 elements. The 19 elements of the astral body are mental, emotional, and lifetronic. The 19 components are intelligence, ego, feeling, mind, sense consciousness, 5 instruments of knowledge, the subtle counterparts of the senses of sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, 5 instruments of action, the mental correspondence for the executive abilities to procreate, excrete, talk, walk, and exercise manual skill, and 5 instruments of life force, those empowered to perform the crystallizing, assimilating, eliminating, metabolizing, and circulating functions of the body. This subtle astral encasement of 19 elements survives the death of the physical body, which is made of 16 gross chemical elements. God thought out different ideas within himself and projected them into dreams. Lady Cosmic Dream thus sprang out, decorated in all her colossal endless ornaments of relativity. In 35 thought categories of the causal body, God elaborated all the complexities of man's 19 astral and 16 physical counterparts. By condensation of vibratory forces, first subtle, then gross, he produced man's astral body and finally his physical form. According to the law of relativity, by which the prime simplicity has become the bewildering manifold, the causal cosmos and causal body are different from the astral cosmos and astral body. The physical cosmos and physical body are likewise characteristically at variance with the other forms of creation. The fleshly body is made of the fixed, objectified dreams of the Creator. The dualities are ever present on earth, disease and health, pain and pleasure, loss and gain. Human beings find imitation and resistance in three-dimensional matter. When man's desire to live is severely shaken by disease or other causes, death arrives. The heavy overcoat of the flesh is temporarily shed. The soul, however, remains encased in the astral and causal bodies. The cohesive force by which all three bodies are held together is desire. The power of unfulfilled desires is the root of all of man's slavery. Physical desires are rooted in egotism and sense pleasures. The compulsion or temptation of sensory experience is more powerful than the desire force connected with the astral attachments or causal perceptions. Astral desires center around enjoyment in terms of vibration. Astral beings enjoy the ethereal music of the spheres and are entranced by the sight of all creation as exhaustless expressions of changing light. The astral beings also smell, taste, and touch light. Astral desires are thus connected with an astral being's power to precipitate all objects and experiences as forms of light, or as condensed thoughts or dreams. Causal desires are fulfilled by perception only. The nearly free beings, who are encased only in the causal body, see the whole universe as realizations of the dream ideas of God. They can materialize anything and everything in sheer thought. Causal beings therefore consider the enjoyment of physical sensations or astral delights as gross and suffocating to the soul's fine sensibilities. Causal beings work out their desires by materializing them instantly. Those who find themselves covered only by the delicate veil of the causal body can bring universes into manifestation, even as the Creator. Because all creation is made of the cosmic dream texture, the soul, thinly clothed in the causal, has vast realizations of power. A soul, being invisible by nature, can be distinguished only by the presence of its body or bodies. The mere presence of a body signifies that its existence is made possible by unfulfilled desires. So long as the soul of man is encased in one, two, or three body containers, sealed tightly with the corks of ignorance and desires, he cannot merge with the sea of spirit. When the gross physical receptacle is destroyed by the hammer of death, the other two coverings, astral and causal, still remain to prevent the soul from consciously joining the omnipresent life. When desirelessness is attained through wisdom, its power disintegrates the two remaining vessels. The tiny human soul emerges, free at last. It is one with the measureless amplitude. I asked my divine guru to shed further light on the high and mysterious causal world. "The causal world is indescribably subtle," he replied. "In order to understand it, one would have to possess such tremendous powers of concentration that he could close his eyes and visualize the astral cosmos and the physical cosmos in all their vastness. The luminous balloon with the solid basket, as existing in ideas only. If by this superhuman concentration one succeeded in converting or resolving the two cosmoses with all their complexities into sheer ideas, he would then reach the causal world and stand on the borderline of fusion between mind and matter. There one perceives all created things, solids, liquids, gases, electricity, energy, all beings, gods, men, animals, plants, bacteria, as forms of consciousness. Just as a man can close his eyes and realize that he exists, even though his body is invisible to his physical eyes and is present only as an idea. Whatever a human being can do in fancy, a causal being can do in reality. The most colossal imaginative human intelligence is able, in mind only, to range from one extreme thought to another, to skip mentally from planet to planet, or tumble endlessly down a pit of eternity, or soar rocket-like into the galaxied canopy, or scintillate like a searchlight over Milky Ways and the starry spaces. But beings in the causal world have a much greater freedom, and can effortlessly manifest their thoughts into instant objectivity without any material or astral obstruction or karmic limitation. Causal beings realize that the physical cosmos is not primarily constructed of electrons, nor is the astral cosmos basically composed of lifetrons. Both, in reality, are created from the minutest particles of God thought, chopped and divided by Maya, the law of relativity that apparently intervenes to separate creation from its creator. Souls in the causal world recognize one another as individualized points of joyous spirit. Their thought things are the only objects that surround them. Causal beings see the difference between their bodies and thoughts to be merely ideas. As a man closing his eyes can visualize a dazzling white light or a faint blue haze, so causal beings by thought alone are able to see, hear, smell, taste, touch. They create anything or dissolve it by the power of cosmic mind. Both death and rebirth in the causal world are in thought. Causal-bodied beings feast only on the ambrosia of eternally new knowledge. They drink from the springs of peace, roam on the trackless soil of perceptions, swim in the ocean endlessness of bliss. Lo, see their bright thought bodies zoom past trillions of spirit-created planets, fresh bubbles of universes wisdom stars, spectral dreams of golden nebulae in the sky bosom of infinity. Many beings remain for thousands of years in the causal cosmos. By deeper ecstasies, the freed soul then withdraws itself from the little causal body and puts on the vastness of the causal cosmos. All the separate eddies of ideas, particularized waves of power, love, will, joy, peace, intuition, calmness, self-control, and concentration melt into the ever-joyous sea of bliss. No longer does the soul have to experience its joy as an individualized wave of consciousness, but is merged in the one cosmic ocean with all its waves, eternal laughter, thrills, throbs. When a soul is out of the cocoon of the three bodies, it escapes forever from the law of relativity and becomes the ineffable ever-existent. Behold the butterfly of omnipresence, its wings etched with stars and moons and suns. The soul expanded into spirit remains alone in the region of lightless light, darkless dark, thoughtless thought, intoxicated with its ecstasy of joy in God's dream of cosmic creation. A free soul, I ejaculated in awe. When a soul finally gets out of the three jars of bodily delusions, Master continued, it becomes one with the infinite without any loss of individuality. Christ had won this final freedom even before he was born as Jesus. In three stages of his past, symbolized in his earth life as the 3 days of his experience of death and resurrection, he had attained the power to fully arise in spirit. The undeveloped man must undergo countless earthly and astral and causal incarnations in order to emerge from his three bodies. A master who achieves this final freedom may elect to return to earth as a prophet to bring other human beings back to God, or, like myself, he may choose to reside in the astral cosmos. There, a savior assumes some of the burden of the inhabitants' karma, and thus helps them to terminate their cycle of reincarnation in the astral cosmos and go on permanently to the causal spheres. Or a freed soul may enter the causal world to aid its beings to shorten their span in the causal body and thus attain the absolute freedom. Resurrected one, I want to know more about the karma which forces souls to return to the three worlds. I could listen forever, I thought, to my omniscient master. Never in his earth life had I been able at one time to assimilate so much of his wisdom. Now, for the first time, I was receiving a clear, definite insight into the enigmatic interspaces on the checkerboard of life and death. The physical karma, or desires of man, must be completely worked out before his continued stay in astral worlds becomes possible, my guru elucidated in his thrilling voice. 2 kinds of beings live in the astral spheres. Those who still have earthly karma to dispose of, and who must therefore re-inhabit a gross physical body in order to pay their karmic debts, could be classified after physical death as temporary visitors to the astral world, rather than as established residents. Beings with unredeemed earthly karma are not permitted after astral death to go to the high causal sphere of cosmic ideas, but must shuttle to and fro from the physical and astral worlds only, conscious successively of their physical body of 16 gross elements and of their astral body of 19 subtle elements. After each loss of his physical body, however, an undeveloped being from the earth remains for the most part in the deep stupor of death sleep, and is hardly conscious of the beautiful astral sphere. After the astral rest, such a man returns to the material plane for further lessons, gradually accustoming himself through repeated journeys to the worlds of subtle astral texture. Normal or long-established residents of the astral universe, on the other hand, are those who, freed forever from all material longings, need return no more to the gross vibrations of earth. Such beings have only astral and causal karma to work out. At astral death, these beings pass to the infinitely finer and more delicate causal world. At the end of a certain span, determined by cosmic law, these advanced beings then return to Hiranyaloka or a similar high astral planet, reborn in a new astral body to work out their unredeemed astral karma. My son, you may now comprehend more fully that I am resurrected by divine decree, Sri Yukteswar continued, as a saviour of astrally reincarnating souls coming back from the causal sphere in particular, rather than of those astral beings who are coming up from the earth. Those from the earth, if they still retain vestiges of material karma, do not rise to the very high astral planets like Hiranyaloka. Just as most people on earth have not learnt through meditation-acquired vision to appreciate the superior joys and advantages of astral life and thus, after death, desire to return to the limited, imperfect pleasures of earth, so many astral beings, during the normal disintegration of their astral bodies, fail to picture the advanced state of spiritual joy in the causal world, and dwelling on thoughts of the more gross and gaudy astral happiness, yearn to revisit the astral paradise. Heavy astral karma must be redeemed by such beings before they can achieve, after astral death, an unbroken stay in the causal thought world, so thinly partitioned from the Creator. Only when a being has no further desires for experiences in the pleasing-to-the-eye astral cosmos and cannot be tempted to go back there, does he remain in the causal world, completing there the work of redeeming all causal karma or seeds of past desires. The confined soul thrusts out the last of the three corks of ignorance, and emerging from the final jar of the causal body, commingles with the eternal. Now do you understand? Master smiled so enchantingly. Yes, through your grace, I am speechless with joy and gratitude. Never from song or story had I ever received such inspiring knowledge. Though the Hindu scriptures refer to the causal and astral worlds and to man's three bodies, how remote and meaningless those pages compared with the warm authenticity of my resurrected master. For him, indeed, existed not a single undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns. The interpenetration of man's three bodies is expressed in many ways through his threefold nature, my great guru went on. In the wakeful state on earth, a human being is conscious more or less of his three vehicles. When he is sensuously intent on tasting, smelling, touching, listening, or seeing, he is working principally through his physical body. Visualizing or willing, he's working mainly through his astral body. His causal being finds expression when man is thinking or diving deep in introspection or meditation. The cosmical thoughts of genius come to the man who habitually contacts his causal body. In this sense, an individual may be classified broadly as a material man, an energetic man, or an intellectual man. A man identifies himself about 16 hours daily with his physical vehicle. Then he sleeps. If he dreams, he remains in his astral body, effortlessly creating any object, even as do the astral beings. If man's sleep be deep and dreamless, for several hours he is able to transfer his consciousness, or sense of I-ness, to the causal body. Such sleep is revivifying. A dreamer is contacting his astral and not his causal body. His sleep is not fully refreshing. I had been lovingly observing Sri Yukteswar while he gave his wondrous exposition. Angelic Guru, I said, your body looks exactly as it did when I last wept over it in the Puri ashram. Oh yes, my new body is a perfect copy of the old one. I materialize or dematerialize this form any time at will, much more frequently than I did while on earth. By quick dematerialization, I now travel instantly by light express from planet to planet, or indeed from astral to causal or to physical cosmos. My divine guru smiled. Though you move about so fast these days, I had no difficulty in finding you at Bombay. O Master, I was grieving so deeply about your death. Ah, wherein did I die? Isn't there some contradiction? Sri Yukteswar's eyes were twinkling with love and amusement. You were only dreaming on earth. On that earth, you saw my dream body, he went on. Later you buried that dream image. Now my finer, fleshly body, which you behold and are even now embracing rather closely, is resurrected on another finer dream planet of God. Some day that finer dream body and finer dream planet will pass away. They too are not forever. All dream bubbles must eventually burst at a final wakeful touch. Differentiate, my son Yogananda, between dreams and reality. This idea of Vedantic resurrection struck me with wonder. I was ashamed that I had pitied Master when I had seen his lifeless body at Puri. I comprehended at last that my Guru had always been fully awake in God, perceiving his own life and passing on earth, and his present resurrection as nothing more than relativities of divine ideas in the cosmic dream. I have now told you, Yogananda, the truths of my life, death, and resurrection. Grieve not for me. Rather broadcast everywhere the story of my resurrection from the God-dreamed earth of men to another God-dreamed planet of astrally garbed souls. New hope will be infused into the hearts of misery-mad, death-fearing dreamers of the world. Yes, Master, how willingly would I share with others my joy at his resurrection. On earth my standards were uncomfortably high, unsuited to the natures of most men. Often I scolded you more than I should have. You passed my tests. Your love shone through the clouds of all reprimands. He added tenderly, I have also come today to tell you, never again shall I wear the stern gaze of censure. I shall scold you no more. How much I had missed the chastisements of my great guru. Each one had been a guardian angel of protection. Dearest Master, rebuke me 1,000,000 times. Do, scold me now. I shall chide you no more. His divine voice was grave, yet with an undercurrent of laughter. You and I shall smile together, so long as our two forms appear different in the Maya dream of God. Finally, we shall merge as one in the cosmic beloved. Our smiles shall be his smile. Our unified song of joy vibrating throughout eternity, to be broadcast to God-tuned souls. Sri Yukteswar gave me light on certain matters which I cannot reveal here. During the 2 hours that he spent with me in the Bombay hotel room, he answered my every question. A number of world prophecies uttered by him that June day in 1936 have already come to pass. I leave you now, beloved one. At these words I felt Master melting away within my encircling arms. My child, his voice rang out, vibrating into my very soul firmament, whenever you enter the door of Nirvikalpa Samadhi and call on me, I shall come to you in flesh and blood, even as today. With this celestial promise, Sri Yukteswar vanished from my sight. A cloud voice repeated in musical thunder, tell all, whosoever knows by Nirvikalpa realization that your earth is a dream of God can come to the finer dream-created planet of Hiranyaloka and there find me, resurrected in a body exactly like my earthly one. Yogananda, tell all. Gone was the sorrow of parting, the pity and grief for his death, long robber of my peace, now fled in stark shame. Bliss poured forth like a fountain through endless, newly opened soul pores. Anciently clogged with disuse, they now widened in purity at the driving flood of ecstasy. My former incarnations appeared before my inward eye in motion-picture-like sequence. Good and bad karma of the past was dissolved in the cosmic light shed around me by Master's divine visit. In this chapter of my autobiography, I have obeyed my Guru's behest and spread the glad tidings, though they confound once more an incurious generation. Grovelling, man knows well. Despair is seldom alien. Yet these are perversities, no part of man's true lot. The day he wills, he is set on the path to freedom. Too long has he hearkened to the dank pessimism of his dust thou art counsellors, heedless of the unconquerable soul. I was not the only one privileged to behold the resurrected Guru. One of Sri Yukteswar's chelas was an aged woman, affectionately known as Ma, Mother, whose home was close to the Puri Hermitage. Master had often stopped to chat with her during his morning walk. On the evening of March the 16th, 1936, Ma arrived at the ashram and asked to see her Guru. Why, Master died a week ago. Swami Sevananda, now in charge of the Puri Hermitage, looked at her sadly. That's impossible, she protested with a smile. No, Sivananda recounted details of the burial. Come, he said, I will take you to the front garden to his grave. Ma shook her head. There is no grave for him. This morning, at 10 o'clock, he passed in his usual walk before my door. I talked to him for several minutes in the bright outdoors. Come this evening to the ashram, he said. I am here. Blessings pour on this old grey head. The deathless Guru wanted me to understand in what transcendent body he visited me this morning. The astounded Sebananda knelt before her. Ma, he said, what a weight of grief you lift from my heart. He is risen. Chapter 44 With Mahatma Gandhi at Wardha. Welcome to Wardha. Madhav Desai, secretary to Mahatma Gandhi, greeted Miss Bletch, Mr. Wright, and me with these cordial words and the gifts of wreaths of khadar, homespun cotton. Our little group had just arrived at the station in Wardha on an early morning in August, glad to leave the dust and heat of the train. Consigning our luggage to a bullock cart, we entered an open motor car with Mr. Desai and his companions, Baba Sahib Deshmukh and Dr. Pingali. A short drive over the muddy country roads brought us to Maganwadi, the ashram of India's political saint. Mr. Desai led us at once to the writing room, where, cross-legged, sat Mahatma Gandhi, pen in one hand and a scrap of paper in the other, on his face a vast, winning, warm-hearted smile. Welcome, he scribbled in Hindi. It was a Monday, his weekly day of silence. Though this was our first meeting, we beamed on each other affectionately. In 1925, Mahatma Gandhi had honoured the Ranchi school by a visit, and had inscribed in its guest book a gracious tribute. The tiny 100-pound saint radiated physical, mental, and spiritual health. His soft brown eyes shone with intelligence, sincerity, and discrimination. This statesman has matched wits and emerged the victor in 1,000 legal, social, and political battles. No other leader in the world has attained the secure niche in the hearts of his people that Gandhi occupies for India's unlettered millions. Their spontaneous tribute is his famous title, Mahatma, Great Soul. For them alone, Gandhi confines his attire to the widely cartooned loincloth, symbol of his oneness with the downtrodden masses who can afford no more. The ashram residents are wholly at your disposal. Please call on them for any service. With characteristic courtesy, the Mahatma handed me this hastily written note as Mr. Desai led our party from the writing room toward the guest house. Our guide led us through orchards and flowering fields to a tiled roof building with latticed windows. A front yard well, 25 feet across, was used, Mr. Desai said, for watering stock. Nearby stood a revolving cement wheel for threshing rice. Each of our small bedrooms proved to contain only the irreducible minimum, a bed handmade of rope. The whitewashed kitchen boasted a faucet in one corner and a fire pit for cooking in the other. Simple Arcadian sounds reached our ears. The cries of crows and sparrows, the lowing of cattle, and the rap of chisels being used to chip stones. Observing Mr. Wright's travel diary, Mr. Desai opened it and wrote on a page a list of Satyagraha vows taken by all of the Mahatma's earnest followers, Satyagrahis. Non-violence, truth, non-stealing, celibacy, non-possession, body labour, control of the palate, fearlessness, equal respect for all religions, Swadeshi, use of home manufactures, freedom from untouchability. These 11 should be observed as vows in a spirit of humility. Gandhi himself signed this page on the following day, giving the date also, August 27, 1935. 2 hours after our arrival, my companions and I were summoned to lunch. The Mahatma was already seated under the arcade of the ashram porch across the courtyard from his study. About 25 barefooted Satyagrahis were squatting before brass cups and plates. A community chorus of prayer, then a meal served from large brass pots containing chapatis, whole wheat unleavened bread, sprinkled with ghee, talsari, boiled and diced vegetables, and a lemon jam. The Mahatma ate chapatis, boiled beets, some raw vegetables and oranges. On the side of his plate was a large lump of very bitter neem leaves, a notable blood cleanser. With a spoon, he separated a portion and placed it on my dish. I bolted it down with water, remembering my childhood days when mother had forced me to swallow the unpleasant dose. Gandhi, however, was eating the neem paste bit by bit, without distaste. In this trifling incident, I noted the Mahatma's ability to detach his mind from the senses at will. I recalled a much-publicized appendectomy performed on him some years ago. Refusing anaesthetics, the saint had chatted cheerfully with his devotees throughout the operation, his calm smile revealing his unawareness of pain. The afternoon brought me an opportunity for a chat with Gandhi's noted disciple, daughter of an English admiral, Miss Madeline Slade, now called Meera Ben. Her strong, calm face lit with enthusiasm as she told me, in flawless Hindi, of her daily activities. Rural reconstruction work is rewarding. A group of us go every morning at 5 o'clock to serve the nearby villagers and teach them simple hygiene. We make it a point to clean their latrines and thatched mud huts. The villagers are illiterate. They cannot be educated except by example, she laughed gaily. I looked in admiration at this high-born Englishwoman, whose true Christian humility enables her to do the scavengering work usually performed only by untouchables. I came to India in 1925, she told me. In this land, I feel that I have come back home. Now I would never be willing to return to my old life and old interests. We discussed America for a while. I'm always pleased and amazed, she said, to see the deep interest in spiritual subjects shown by many of the Americans who visit India. Meera Ben's hands were soon busy at a charkha, spinning wheel. Owing to the Mahatma's efforts, charkhas are now omnipresent in rural India. Gandhi has sound economic and cultural reasons for encouraging the revival of cottage industries, but he does not counsel a fanatical repudiation of all modern progress. Machinery, trains, automobiles, the telegraph have played important parts in his own colossal life. 50 years of public service, in prison and out, wrestling daily with practical details and harsh realities in the political world, have only increased his balance, open-mindedness, sanity and humorous appreciation of the quaint human spectacle. Our trio enjoyed a 6 o'clock supper as guests of Baba Saheb Deshmukh. The 7 p.m. prayer hour found us back at Maganwadi Ashram, climbing to the roof, where 30 Satyagrahis were grouped in a semicircle around Gandhi. He was squatting on a straw mat, an ancient pocket watch propped up before him. The fading sun cast a last gleam over the palms and banyans. The hum of night and the crickets had started. The atmosphere was serenity itself. I was enraptured. A solemn chant, led by Mr. Desai, with responses from the group, then a Gita reading. The Mahatma motioned me to give the concluding prayer. Such divine unison of thought and aspiration, a memory forever, the Warda rooftop meditation under the early stars. Punctually at 8 o'clock, Gandhi ended his silence. The Herculean labours of his life require him to apportion his time minutely. "Welcome, Swamiji." The Mahatma's greeting this time was not via paper. We had just descended from the roof to his writing room. Simply furnished with square mats, no chairs, a low desk with books, papers and a few ordinary pens, not fountain pens, a nondescript clock ticked in a corner, an all-pervasive aura of peace and devotion, Gandhi was bestowing one of his captivating, cavernous, almost toothless smiles. Years ago, he explained, I started my weekly observance of a day of silence as a means for gaining time to look after my correspondence. But now those 24 hours have become a vital spiritual need. A periodical decree of silence is not a torture, but a blessing. I agreed wholeheartedly. The Mahatma questioned me about America and Europe. We discussed India and world conditions. Mahadev, Gandhi said, as Mr. Desai entered the room, please make arrangements at Town Hall for Swamiji to speak there on yoga tomorrow night. As I was bidding the Mahatma good night, he considerately handed me a bottle of citronella oil. The Warda mosquitoes don't know a thing about Ahimsa, Swamiji, he said, laughing. The following morning, our little group breakfasted early on whole wheat porridge with molasses and milk. At 10:30, we were called to the ashram porch for lunch with Gandhi and the Satyagrahis. Today, the menu included brown rice, a new selection of vegetables, and cardamom seeds. Noon found me strolling about the ashram grounds, onto the grazing land of a few imperturbable cows. The protection of cows is a passion with Gandhi. The cow to me means the entire subhuman world, extending man's sympathies beyond his own species, the Mahatma has explained. Man, through the cow, is enjoined to realize his identity with all that lives. Why the ancient rishis selected the cow for apotheosis is obvious to me. The cow in India was the best comparison. She was the giver of plenty. Not only did she give milk, but she also made agriculture possible. The cow is a poem of pity. One reads pity in the gentle animal. She is the second mother to millions of mankind. Protection of the cow means protection of the whole dumb creation of God. The appeal of the lower order of creation is all the more forceful because it is speechless. Certain daily rituals are enjoined on the Orthodox Hindu. One is Bhuta Yagya, an offering of food to the animal kingdom. This ceremony symbolizes man's realization of his obligations to less evolved forms of creation, instinctively tied to body identification, a delusion that afflicts man also, but lacking the liberating quality of reason peculiar to humanity. Bhuta Yagya thus reinforces man's readiness to succor the weak, as man in turn is comforted by countless solicitudes of higher unseen beings. Humanity is also under bond for rejuvenating gifts of nature, prodigal in earth, sea, and sky. The evolutionary barrier of incommunicability among nature, animals, man, and astral angels is surmounted by daily yagyas, rituals of silent love. Two other daily yagyas are Pitri and Nri. Pitri Yagya is an offering of oblations to ancestors, a symbol of man's acknowledgement of his debt to past generations, whose store of wisdom illuminates humanity today. Nri Yagya is an offering of food to strangers or the poor, a symbol of the present responsibilities of man, his duties to contemporaries. In the early afternoon, I fulfilled a neighbouring Nriyagya by a visit to Gandhi's ashram for little girls. Mr. Wright accompanied me on the 10-minute drive. Tiny young flower-like faces atop long-stemmed colourful saris. At the end of a brief talk in Hindi that I was giving outdoors, the skies unloosed a sudden downpour. Laughing, Mr. Wright and I climbed aboard the car and sped back to Maganwadi amid sheets of driving silver. Such tropical intensity and splash. Re-entering the guest house, I was struck anew by the stark simplicity and evidences of self-sacrifice which are everywhere present. The Gandhi vow of non-possession came early in his married life, renouncing an extensive legal practice which had been yielding him an annual income of more than $20,000, the Mahatma dispersed all his wealth to the poor. Sri Yukteswar used to poke gentle fun at the commonly inadequate conceptions of renunciation. "A beggar cannot renounce wealth," Master would say. "If a man laments, 'My business has failed, my wife has left me, I will renounce all and enter a monastery,' to what worldly sacrifice is he referring? He did not renounce wealth and love. They renounced him." Saints, like Gandhi, on the other hand, have made not only tangible material sacrifices, but also the more difficult renunciation of selfish motive and private goal, merging their inmost being in the stream of humanity as a whole. The Mahatma's remarkable wife, Kasturbai, did not object when he failed to set aside any part of his wealth for the use of her and their children. Married in early youth, Gandhi and his wife took a vow of celibacy after the birth of 4 sons. A tranquil heroine in the intense drama that has been their life together, Kasturbai has followed her husband to prison, shared his 3-week fasts, and fully borne her share of his endless responsibilities. She has paid Gandhi the following tribute. "I thank you for having had the privilege of being your lifelong companion and helpmate. I thank you for the most perfect marriage in the world, based on brahmacharya, self-control, and not on sex. I thank you for having considered me your equal in your life work for India. I thank you for not being one of those husbands who spend their time in gambling, racing, women, wine and song, tiring of their wives and children as a little boy quickly tires of his childhood toys. How thankful I am that you are not one of those husbands who devote their time to growing rich on the exploitation of the labour of others. How thankful I am that you put God and country before bribes, that you have the courage of your convictions, and a complete and implicit faith in God. How thankful I am for a husband who put God and his country before me. I am grateful to you for your tolerance of me and of my shortcomings of youth, when I grumbled and rebelled against the change you made in our mode of living, from so much to so little. As a young child, I lived in your parents' home. Your mother was a great and good woman. She trained me, taught me how to be a brave, courageous wife, and how to keep the love and respect of her son, my future husband. As the years passed, and you became India's most beloved leader, I had none of the fears that beset the wife who may be cast aside when her husband has climbed the ladder of success, as so often happens in other countries. I knew that death would still find us, husband and wife." For years, Kasturbai performed the duties of treasurer of the public funds, which the idolized Mahatma is able to raise by millions. Many humorous stories are told in Indian homes to the effect that husbands are nervous about their wives wearing any jewellery to a Gandhi meeting. The Mahatma's magical tongue, pleading for the downtrodden, charms the golden bracelets and diamond necklaces right off the arms and necks of the wealthy into the collection basket. One day, the public treasurer, Kasturbai, could not account for a disbursement of 4 rupees. Gandhi duly published an auditing in which he inexorably pointed out his wife's 4-rupee discrepancy. I had often told this story before classes of my American students. One evening, a woman in the hall had given an outraged gasp. Mahatma or no Mahatma, she had cried, if he were my husband, I would have given him a black eye for such an unnecessary public insult. After some good-humoured banter had passed between us on the subject of American wives and Hindu wives, I had gone on to a fuller explanation. Mrs. Gandhi considers the Mahatma not as her husband, but as her guru, one who has the right to discipline her for even insignificant errors, I had pointed out. Some time after Kasturbai had been publicly rebuked, Gandhi was sentenced to prison on a political charge. As he was calmly bidding farewell to his wife, she fell at his feet. Master, she said humbly, if I have ever offended you, please forgive me. At 3 o'clock that afternoon in Wardha, I betook myself by previous appointment to the writing room of the saint who had been able to make an unflinching disciple out of his own wife. Rare miracle. Gandhi looked up with his unforgettable smile. Mahatmaji, I said, as I squatted beside him on the uncushioned mat, please tell me your definition of ahimsa. The avoidance of harm to any living creature in thought or deed. Beautiful ideal, but the world will always ask, may one not kill a cobra to protect a child or oneself? I could not kill a cobra without violating two of my vows, fearlessness and non-killing. I would rather try inwardly to calm the snake by vibrations of love. I cannot possibly lower my standards to suit my circumstances. With his charming candour, he added, I must confess that I could not serenely carry on this conversation were I faced by a cobra. I remarked on several very recent Western books on diet which lay on his desk. Yes, diet is important in the Satyagraha movement, as everywhere else, he said with a chuckle, because I advocate complete continence for Satyagrahis, I am always trying to find out the best diet for the celibate. One must conquer the palate before he can control the procreative instinct. Semi-starvation or unbalanced diets are not the answer. After overcoming the inward greed for food, a Satyagrahi must continue to follow a rational vegetarian diet with all necessary vitamins, minerals, calories, and so forth. By inward and outward wisdom in regard to eating, the Satyagrahi's sexual fluid is easily turned into vital energy for the whole body. The Mahatma and I compared our knowledge of good meat substitutes. The avocado is excellent, I said. There are numerous avocado groves near my center in California. Gandhi's face lit with interest. I wonder if they will grow at Wardha. The Satyagrahis would appreciate a new food. I will be sure to send some avocado plants from Los Angeles to Wardha, I added. Eggs are a high-protein food. Are they forbidden to Satyagrahis? Not unfertilized eggs, the Mahatma laughed reminiscently. For years, I would not countenance their use. Even now, I personally do not eat them. One of my daughters-in-law was once dying of malnutrition. Her doctors insisted on eggs. I would not agree, and advised him to give her some egg substitute. Gandhiji, the doctor said, unfertilized eggs contain no life sperm. No killing is involved. I then gladly gave permission for my daughter-in-law to eat eggs. She was soon restored to health. On the previous night, Gandhi had expressed a wish to receive the Kriya Yoga of Lahiri Mahashai. I was touched by the Mahatma's open-mindedness and spirit of inquiry. He is childlike in his divine quest, revealing that pure receptivity which Jesus praised in children. Of such is the kingdom of heaven. The hour for my promised instruction had arrived. Several Satyagrahis now entered the room, Mr. Desai, Dr. Pingali, and a few others who desired the Kriya technique. I first taught the little class the physical Yogoda exercises. The body is visualized as divided into 20 parts. The will directs energy in turn to each section. Soon everyone was vibrating before me like a human motor. It was easy to observe the rippling effect on Gandhi's 20 body parts, at nearly all times, completely exposed to view. Though very thin, he is not unpleasingly so. The skin of his body is smooth and unwrinkled. Later, I initiated the group into the liberating technique of Kriya Yoga. The Mahatma